the state agreed to send this to every district and to encourage every district to then send it in turn to every principal. They agreed in doing so to frame this as the, quote, considered position of the state of Florida.
Hey, everybody, what's up? And welcome to Summarily, a podcast for busy lawyers, where lawyers like you come for practice tips, free CLE courses, and case law updates. They also listen to Summarily for commentary on legal news and developments, and that is what's on tap in this episode. This is your host, Robert Scavone Jr. I am an appellate lawyer at Florida Appeals, and I clerked at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, as well as at the 3rd District Court of Appeal here in Florida. You will recall that Equality Florida, on behalf of several LGBTQ students, parents, and teachers, sued Governor DeSantis et al. In federal court alleging violations of due process, equal protection, and the First Amendment. The lawsuit was in response to House Bill 1557, which has become known as the Don't Say Gay Law. Joining me today are John C. Quinn, a partner at Kaplan, Hecker & Fink, and D. Brandon Trice, counsel at Kaplan, Hecker & Fink. John and Brandon were part of a team of lawyers led by Robbie Kaplan, who, along with the National Center for Lesbian Rights, represented Equality Florida. Brandon and John, thank you very much for joining me. I'm sure you're really busy at this point. You know, even though the settlement is done, I'm sure there's all sorts of stuff going on, but I appreciate you carving out some time to talk to me.
Thanks for having us. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah.
Thank you. So I thought we'd break the conversation down into three parts. Basically, you know, let's start off by just kind of some general outlines of what the bill proposed or the law proposed, and we'll talk a little bit about your complaint, and then we'll finish up with, you know, the settlement, what it means for moving forward and things like that. So the bill, House Bill 1557, you know, you read the text of the bill and it kind of seems a little benign. You know, it's like parental notification and no gender ID or sexual orientation until third grade. But in practice, what did you all allege that the law would really prevent?
Why don't I try this one and then invite Brandon to add some points or correct anything I might get wrong. So let's start with the text of the law. As Justice Kagan likes to remind us, we're all textualists now.
Indeed.
And you know what it says, what the operative language that we challenged in our case says, is that it prohibits classroom instruction on gender identity or sexual orientation. It's a categorical prohibition, at least originally from grades K to three. And then above that, it's a prohibition on such instruction, if not age and developmentally appropriate. I think one of the most important things to note out of the gate is all of those terms are undefined in the statute. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't say what classroom instruction means. Is that the same thing as curriculum? Is it something broader? I should add, it also has a phrase that says, by school personnel or third parties. So why school personnel? What does that mean beyond teachers? Does it include the school nurse? Does it include principal? Does it include, you know,
the football coach?
Yeah, the football coach, a supervisor of a GSA, a health advisor. And then if school personnel isn't broad enough, what is or third parties supposed to mean? Are we talking about parents coming in at career day now? Are we talking about the students themselves? And how are non-school personnel giving classroom instruction? That's all before we even get to the terms sexual orientation and gender identity and what it would mean to have instruction on those subjects.
Right?
If I think we all know from the legislative history, from the reality of what happened here, that a book about, you know, two mommies or something was something these legislators might have had concern about, but it wasn't immediately clear why that was any different than a book about a mommy and a daddy. Why is one instruction on gender identity and the other is not? So it raised, you know, a thousand questions right from the start. And then I've already mentioned the legislative history, right? It was passed by legislators who were saying things publicly in the record, like, we're just sick of hearing about all these kids coming out and being treated like heroes.
Yeah, let me just quote for a minute from your complaint.
Sure.
The bill sponsor in the Senate has stated that the law is meant to prohibit discrimination or discussion of sexual orientation and gender identities that do not comport with Florida's supposed, quote, core belief system and values, whatever that might mean. as though Florida has one specific core belief system and values. He has also stated that the bill is intended to prevent students from coming out in school to their peers from being treated as celebrities, quote unquote.
There you go. You got the exact quote. It wasn't heroes, it was celebrities, which I find even more pernicious in a way.
Pretty damning.
Exactly, right? So you've got the text that's hopelessly vague and raises all these questions. You've got this kind of legislative history showing a clear intent. And then you've got an enforcement scheme. And the enforcement scheme basically functions by saying any parent in and around a school who thinks that there's been a violation or doesn't need to think, can plead one or is prepared to plead one, can assert a claim that there may be some initial administrative process, but ultimately can assert a claim against the school district. And if the parent ultimately prevails, they can recover their fees. But if the school district prevails, they can't. So you've not only taken enforcement away from any centralized state actor where there would be some predictability and, you know, policy developing over time, and you know, just that basic common law process by which things get distilled and standards become rules. Like, you've removed it from a centralized administrative process where that could happen. Right. You've empowered an army of potential enforcers, and you've slanted the playing field a little bit with this fee provision. And so what all of that together does, very predictably, we would argue foreseeably, was incentivize everybody at every level of the school system all the way down to make sure that they weren't the ones that triggered some lawsuit from a parent that is unavoidably going to cost the school district lots of money.
Yeah, so tremendous chilling effect.
Exactly. So principals are overcorrecting, teachers are overcorrecting, kids are overcorrecting, right. And the answers to their questions aren't in the statute. So they start scraping safe space stickers off windows. They start pulling pride flags down. They start taking books off the shelf. They cancel the GSAs. Miami-Dade School District voted unanimously the year before this bill to recognize Pride mm-hmm. Month mm-hmm. after the bill and citing the bill explicitly as the yep. reason they voted not to.
Yep.
So the effects were very, very widespread. And I think that was pretty clearly the intent. But I don't know, Brandon, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great explanation. And just hearing all of that just riles me up more. Again, it makes me remember all the things that they did. I mean, I think just to add a little bit to that, before, during the challenge that we brought, perhaps after, they've done everything that they can to make it vague and make clear what their intention is while trying to keep it facially neutral. So just to give a few more examples, for instance, John mentioned curriculum. There are Florida statutes that mention curriculum. This doesn't. It doesn't say that. It says classroom instruction. That's intentional. There already was a statute that provided that human sexuality would be appropriate for particular grades. This doesn't do that. And in fact, that's not that, because that's not what it was supposed to do. And in fact, there were amendments that were proposed on the floor and they were shot down repeatedly. And I think we quoted in our complaint, but the legislature, the Senate sponsor said it would gut the effect of the bill. Everybody knew what it was supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And so they kept it intentionally vague and broad in its language so that they could terrify everybody into towing the line and preventing any kind of possible mention or discussion as the preamble references of LGBT people. I think one other thing that is really notable here is that even while we were bringing this case, the Florida Department of Education implemented a rule that applied the prescription directly to educators. And educators are defined in the Florida code to include your coaches, as you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. principal, your librarian, anybody and everybody. So when we initially were going through the process of motion to dismiss, the state says, well, it doesn't apply to anybody but school districts. Well, that's, everybody knows that's not really what it's doing. It's acting on anybody who acts in the school system because you're predictably going to respond. But in case you have any doubts, the Florida Department of Education is going to directly implement it and onto all these actors as well. So the vagueness was reinforced with actual conduct by the agencies that were going to make sure that this threat was acting on anybody and everybody who might think that they have some sort of, you know, cover to be able to not adhere to what's frankly just a discriminatory law.
Yeah. And your partner, Robbie Kaplan, noted in a recent Law 360 article that, you know, just as another example, she said, for example, there were concerns that a kindergartner who happened to have two parents of the same gender and received an assignment to draw their families wouldn't be able to do so accurately for fear that this would be some sort of violation of the law.
Right. Is that a third party now providing classroom instruction about? And in fact, I think we alleged this in the complaint. It might have been in one of the amended complaints, because this, you know, as events unfolded, we continued to amend and point to more real world examples of what was happening. But one of our plaintiffs had described an experience in which their young child asked his teacher, "Can I talk about my two moms?" And the teacher said, "You know, I'm not sure, but it'd be best not to," words to that effect. Wow. So yeah, there were many clear examples of this.
Yeah, just an effort to kind of really devalue people.
Absolutely. Well, particular people anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Let me pause for a moment to thank BetterHelp for sponsoring this podcast. Early in my career, I battled depression. I was unhappy at my job, and the discontent began affecting my marriage. I tried to work through it on my own, but could not shake the feelings of inadequacy and the thought that my life wasn't meaningful. Thankfully, I found help. Mental health counseling changed my life, and BetterHelp can give you the tools you need to approach your life in a very different way. BetterHelp's mission is to make therapy more affordable and more accessible. All you have to do is answer a few questions, and BetterHelp's online platform will pair you with a professional therapist in as little as a few days. And if your therapist isn't the right person for you, you can easily switch to a new therapist at no additional cost. To sign up and support this podcast, go to betterhelp.com/summarily and get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp. That's betterhelp.com/summarily. Check the show notes for the link. If you're struggling like I did, and like so many of us do, consider online therapy with BetterHelp and start working on your mental health today. So let's move to the complaint. You've discussed quite a bit about vagueness. Count one was a due process vagueness count. And again, quoting from the article that Robbie was interviewed for, the settlement reflected the core problem. The single biggest problem with the law, which was how it was written, and that it was so vague that no one really understood what it covered. I mean, you guys have covered some of that already. Anything else you want to talk about in terms of the count for vagueness?
No, I think I would just underscore a point that Brandon made here too. Like, there's two sides to the coin. The vagueness is what allows the pernicious effect to happen in a way that's a little harder to, you know, bring to account. So our other claims, as I'm sure you'll get to, had to do with equal protection and non-discrimination.
We're going to get to all those, yeah.
But it's two sides of the same coin. If they flat out said, "You're not allowed to talk about gay people or gay families, and you've got to take down pride flags," they've got a pretty serious statutory constitutional problem. And so it's the slanting of the playing field, the vague language, the enforcement scheme, all of that is the kind of tip of the spear, as Robbie said, the biggest problem here, because it's what allows everything else to be a little more nebulous and harder to pin down.
Brandon, maybe you can talk a little bit about count two, equal protection. What was the allegation there?
Sure. Yeah. So equal protection, I mean, obviously the law on its face is not discriminatory. It purports to be facially neutral. It says don't talk about sexual orientation or gender identity when you're providing classroom instruction. So what we did was we relied upon a claim based upon There's a case law, a case called Greater Birmingham Ministries, which sets forth an 8-factor test, which I'm not going to bore you with, but it gets into the historical backdrop, the statements that are made by legislators on the floor, et cetera, all the kind of things that you would think about. Okay, you've tried to not expressly say that you're discriminating against gay people. Now let's talk about how you might actually intend to be doing that. And so we relied upon some of the stuff we've discussed already. I mean, the legislators and the governors and his spokespersons, like all their words against them, because, I mean, they couldn't help themselves to make clear that, especially on transgender issues, that was a very big focal point of, I think it was called an anti-grooming bill by Governor DeSantis and by his spokesperson at the time. So, you know, it was no question to us, at least, that we had plenty of evidence, both from the Senate sponsor, from the House sponsor, from the governor, from his spokespersons, that this is clearly not a law about prohibiting discussion about sexual orientation or gender identity writ large. It's specifically about shutting down. And I think at one point in our many briefings that we made in the case, we said, you know, look, why don't you look on the other side? Can you find any instance when anybody in the legislature or the governor's office ever said anything about mommies and daddies or about straight people or about, you know, whatever. No, there's nothing like that. Nobody ever said anything like that. And that's an incredibly telling point. So yeah. We brought this claim, which is based upon legislative intent, to try to get around the otherwise facially neutral statute.
Then you had counts 3, 4, and 5 are First Amendment challenges. Brandon, maybe you can talk about the first one was a right to receive information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the right to receive information was also a really important claim and probably my favorite claim that we brought. It's very interesting. It's a little bit in flux, perhaps, in Supreme Court and precedent and status, but essentially everybody knows that schools, local school districts, have a lot of control over the curriculum. Again, a term that was not used here in the statute. But there are exceptions to that. The First Amendment, the Constitution is not inapplicable to the exercise of that discretion over how people are learning, the youngest people in our society are learning about what society is and what life is like. And the particular standard is reasonably related to a legitimate pedagogical concern. And it would not surprise you perhaps to know that explicit statements of discrimination are not reasonably related to a legitimate pedagogical concern. So we relied in large part upon the same kind of statements that we had from the legislature and from the governor to say that, you know, whatever the bar is in terms of stating a claim for the right to receive information, we've cleared it here. This was not based upon like people thinking about what's best for students in terms of a good education. It was clearly just discriminatory. And so that does state a First Amendment claim. We have seen, including in I think in our case and in other cases where there were similar challenges, states taking the position that school instruction is government speech and therefore shouldn't be subject to that at all, which is a pretty remarkable and absurd position to take, because you can imagine what that would mean if you want to teach that one race is superior to another. If you want to teach that women should all be in the home, that's effectively the outcome of that position, unless you just trust everybody. And as we can see from this case, you shouldn't trust anybody for this kind of stuff. So yeah, that was that claim.
And John, what about the freedom of expression, count 4?
Yeah, I think in some ways it's the other side of the coin. Insofar as this law is prohibiting students from drawing pictures, teachers from responding to incidents of bullying, teachers from teaching their lesson plans in a free and equal way, you know, it is constraining speech through the chilling effect that we've already sort of discussed. Yeah.
And then you had another count under the First Amendment, overbreath, which is generally a pretty tough argument to make. Tell us just briefly about that particular count.
Brandon, you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I have to be honest. It is a tough one, and we include it.
Yeah.
Certainly, I think if I recall correctly, it's generally that there are a sufficient number of applications that are unconstitutional as compared to the constitutional applications, such that the entire statute should be stricken.
Yeah, it sweeps in otherwise protected speech.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it goes to the point Brandon was making too about, like, we always acknowledged that the state has pretty, and that localities have pretty wide authority when it comes to regulating curriculum. But, you know, there are some limits to that. You can't regulate curriculum in ways that teach overtly discriminatory messages and the like. But there is wide authority there. And so, you know, if insofar as the face of this bill, I'm jumping way ahead here, but where I think we've landed now post-settlement is just that we're trying to take certain subjects off the table in certain grades and in a truly equal non-discriminatory fashion. Like, this is a claim that says, okay, if that is true as to some portion of this bill, the bill is written and has the purpose and effect of going so far beyond that in a way that stifles all of this other speech and limits speech and interferes. You know, I think that's the overbreadth framing for the First Amendment issues we've already talked about.
Okay. And then finally, we had a Title IX discrimination based on race. I mean, on sex. I mean, that's pretty self-explanatory. All right. Let's talk a little bit about the settlement. Before we get kind of into the nitty-gritty of it, one thing that was a little bit surprising to me, and maybe this procedural circumstances changed, but, you know, we had the federal judge who had twice dismissed the complaint for lack of standing. And it just seemed to me that, you know, the other party would feel that they were in a pretty strong position in terms of negotiating a settlement and may have been reluctant to enter a settlement. Did anything change procedurally? And if so, what that made the other side feel like, okay, maybe we're not on as firm ground as we thought?
So I having had a lot of those conversations, I think I'll steer clear of trying to venture a guess as to what was in their minds. And candidly, even though happy to get into it, you know, I want to preserve the kind of inner sanctum there.
Of course.
And lawyers have, you know, settlement discussions, and it's important everybody trust everybody. And,
oh, yeah.
And I also want to make a point of really calling out the state lawyers, Daniel Bell, Henry Whitaker. I mean, they were real negotiating partners, and we started in very different places. Our clients started in very different places. It was a very long road, but they were real advocates and negotiating partners, and you know, we were able to really get somewhere. But
yeah, look, Robbie was very complimentary. She said that they were true professionals and that they were courteous and civil, and you know, that all in all, it was a good process in terms of the settlement negotiations. But did anything change procedurally that put you on a stronger footing?
I mean, we filed our appeal, but you're absolutely right. They were coming out of a district court process that had a few standing rulings in sequence that were very positive for them, even as we were filing amended complaints with more and more detail and clarity and real world examples about what was happening because of this law. And they were winning standing rulings anyway that largely painted those concerns as fanciful or as somehow disconnected from the law. So they went, I can't make any bones about it. They went into that appeal in a very strong position. Now, there's always risk. You don't know what panel you're going to get on the 11th Circuit. We did feel like we have a lot of very, very strong arguments. So let's see how this goes in another court. I think we had a lot of confidence. In the end, we really should prevail here. We're right on these standing issues, and we're right about the law.
Yeah,
but
I mean,
procedurally, you know, John, they weren't.
Sure. Yeah, just on the standing point, I mean, you know, at least my interpretation of the way the Supreme Court's going, and maybe that'll change this term, you know, standing has been loosened up quite a bit. The federal judge in this case, at one point, I guess in the first motion to dismiss, found that there was no concrete harm that would have been prevented by stopping enforcement. And then also found, this is a quote, that the plaintiffs merely sought to vindicate, or the, you know, the complaint merely sought to vindicate plaintiffs' strong disagreement with the law and the sentiment they perceived motivated it. I mean, that seems off to me. I mean, you could argue that about any case, that second part about, you know, plaintiffs just disagree with the law. Well, of course, everybody that's challenging a law disagrees with the law. That doesn't mean they lack standing.
Agreed. And of course, in some of the ways we've already talked about, legislative intent and the purpose of the law is relevant to many of these claims. And there's all, you know, there's some recognition in the statement that you've read that there may be a nefarious, discriminatory, inappropriate purpose, or at least it's plausible to allege that. So look, I will limit myself to saying only that
of course,
strongly disagreed with each of those rulings, and maybe even more strongly each time as we added more and more examples of what was going on. And, you know, obviously we get to know these plaintiffs pretty well when we do a case like this. And so, you know, the notion that these folks aren't harmed, when I'm talking to a middle schooler who's trying to organize a GSA and was so excited to get one off the ground and has now been told that no faculty sponsor can be part of it, and so the GSA is being disbanded. And, you know, I've got a seventh grader near tears here trying to explain that to me. You know, the notion that nobody's suffering any harm is just, it's hard to swallow. But we certainly,
and I haven't read the full order the orders dismissing, but that just kind of struck me as a little bit off. Let me pause for a moment to thank the Law Office of Scott N. Richardson, PA, for supporting this podcast. Scott is a former prosecutor who now focuses exclusively on criminal defense, and he is one of the leading criminal defense lawyers in Florida. I have known Scott for several years and litigated against him when I was a prosecutor. All the prosecutors, judges, and defense lawyers that I know regard Scott as a phenomenal lawyer. He is a consummate professional and always zealously advocates for his clients. Scott has been board certified in criminal law for nearly 30 years and has been practicing law for over 40 years. He is a fellow at the American College of Trial Lawyers, an honor bestowed on only 1% of all lawyers in any state. If you need representation, reach out to Scott at 561-471-9600 or find him at scottnrichardsonlaw.com. All right. So the settlement, how long were the negotiations?
I mean, many months. I'd have to pull out a calendar and count. But a lot of it began as we were starting out in the 11th Circuit. You know, there's a mandatory court mediation program. And so there were some conversations, initial conversations among counsel, and maybe some initial suggestions that in a constitutional case like this, a ruling on the pleadings, one side thinks the statute's fine, the other side thinks it's not, you know, is there even any sense in mediating? And that was really right around the time that we started exploring. There are versions of the world with some legislative change or some policy pronouncements or some rule shifts, you know, that we'd be open to discussing with you. And we note, you know, there are quite a lot of concessions and efforts to narrow this thing in your briefs. And so, you know, maybe there's a conversation worth having. I don't know. We want to keep an open mind about it. And so that began a long dialogue and just began to explore, you know, what was possible, both in terms of substance and of framing. It went on for months.
Yeah. Can you disclose who the mediator was?
I'm not sure. Honestly, okay. I'm not sure that I even recall, but it was just a part of the court mediation program. And as I recall it, and I'll try to observe appropriate confidentiality boundaries here, but as I recall it, we had begun to make just some initial progress. We had basically agreed there was something worth talking about and exploring before the actual day came for the mediation. And so I think the ultimate appearance in the court mediation program was essentially just us saying, we're having some productive dialogue. We think it would actually make sense to stay this case. We want to come back every 60 days to just confirm in a status report that that's still productive and that it's ongoing. But for so long as it is, why don't we just press pause here? And the court mediation program, of course, was very glad to hear that. And basically just said, well, we're here as you need us. If you hit a logjam and you want us to break it, you know, let us know. And otherwise, we welcome the proposal and the dialogue. And then we really just did it on our own from that point forward.
Brandon, can you outline for us what are the high points of the settlement? What does it, under the settlement, what has the state agreed to do or not to do?
Sure. So substantively, what the state has agreed to, and specifically the Department and the Board of Education, which are the primary agencies responsible for administering the law, they've agreed that their position on the law is that it doesn't cover, as John said, the many, many things that they said it didn't cover in their briefing. So it doesn't cover safe space stickers. It doesn't cover GSAs. It doesn't cover students talking to other students or to their teachers about LGBT issues or about their family. It doesn't cover a teacher putting a picture of their same-sex spouse on their desk. I mean, it doesn't cover many, you can look through the settlement agreements itself and also their briefing. But I think that it really was a nice way of kind of relying upon agreed statements by both parties to say, okay, then we all agree it doesn't cover this. That's great. Let's have that. So that was the primary part of the settlement agreement. The other, I think, big part of the settlement agreement that we were very pleased with is that the state issued the settlement agreement to all of the school districts. Mm-hmm. And also encouraged the school districts to send the agreement out to all the principals of the various schools within their districts. So it stated the principal state actor's position on the law, told everybody who had been told under the law to act a particular way that, hey, it doesn't mean this. And I think that that's really impactful.
Yeah, 3 points there I want to just underscore, because obviously very attached to the settlement agreement. You know, one, in what Brandon mentioned as the last piece there, that the state agreed to send this to every district and to encourage every district to then send it in turn to every principal. They agreed in doing so to frame this as the, quote, considered position of the state of Florida, which, you know, I think that was language that became important to us, that sure. This is a considered position of the state itself. Yeah. So they agreed to that. And they also agreed, I think, very importantly, that in what remained of the law, which really is curricular regulation, essentially, right? Because the third piece I was going to mention, they agreed pretty broadly that mere references to same-sex attraction, you know, other LGBTQ identity, et cetera, the mere references do not amount to instruction. Instruction is the formal act of teaching. So there are all these specific examples. And then there's that very important general statement. And then that, coming back to the second point, in what remains of the law, this curricular regulation, we're just going to take these subjects kind of off the table or limit them with a standard. the state commits itself in the settlement explicitly to equal treatment for LGBTQ people and non-discrimination in that curricular regulation. So that's a really, really important piece as well.
If I'm correct, is it true that the settlement still provides for parental notification and it still is true that the sexual orientation instruction cannot take place from kindergarten through third grade? Are those still in place?
So in the first piece, parental notification, I think that is a different provision of the statutes. And so our lawsuit wasn't about it. There may well be other lawsuits or implementing rules. I candidly am not even as versed in the details. So the parental notification piece, yeah, was neither a part of our case nor our settlement. On the second piece, yes. I mean, the law continues to say by way of, you know, equal and non-discriminatory curricular regulation that these subjects are, you know, categorically prohibited in formal classroom teaching up to a certain grade and then prohibited beyond that with this age and developmentally appropriate standard.
Right.
I think that the grade level where it changes from a categorical prohibition to a standard qualified one may have moved from grade 3 to grade 8 due to some subsequent amendment or rule. But, you know, in all events, what we're doing here is defining what all those key terms mean and committing to principles and how they'll be implemented. So yes, that piece remains, but it governs only the formal act of teaching and, you know, takes that subject off the table in an equal and non-discriminatory fashion.
Right. And Brandon, in addition to some of the things that you had mentioned, you know, I checked through some bullet points, you know, that the law doesn't prevent references to LGBTQ persons, couples, issues, including in literature and classroom discussions. It doesn't target LGBTQ persons, couples, families, or issues. It requires neutrality. There's an anti-bullying portion of this. Can you talk a little bit about that, Brandon?
Yeah, I mean, that's one additional category that we expressly got in the settlement agreement. And it was obviously extremely important, as is seen in our papers, and as some may recall at the time, actually, I believe the Department of Education issued an instruction in sometime in 2022 saying don't follow Title IX guidance, for instance. So there was some uncertainty over how do you actually comply with non-bullying federal requirements and also just ethical requirements while complying with this law that prohibits teachers and educators, third party school personnel, everybody from providing classroom instruction. So I think that's a really important part. And to go back to what John said earlier and what you referenced, Robbie alluded to, I think it's kind of another point that we thought the state's lawyers, you know, really, when we came to them to talk to them, they said, yeah, we're not intending to do that. So that was a place that we could hopefully find reconciliation.
Yeah. And, you know, it also doesn't, as you said, does not apply to gay straight alliances. It does not apply to library books, and it does not apply to third parties such as non-school personnel, including parents, family members, and guest lecturers. As in all settlement negotiations, nobody walks away completely happy. John and Brandon, what are some of the things that you can tell us that, you know, you fought for, but, you know, were unable to achieve?
Honestly, we see this as very close to, if not all the way to a total victory. I mean, this...
Well, so does the governor.
He has said that. And candidly, the fact that this is an agreement both sides really like and are really ready to stand behind and live up to page by page and word by word is great and will make it more real and avoid a bunch of friction and litigation around it. So I welcome that. And this was never about, you know, beating some Florida legislator. This has always been about protecting the LGBTQ,
vindicating somebody's rights
in Florida schools. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, just you know, just for a little bit of a flavor, you know, the governor said, quote, that this was a major win against a lawsuit that wanted to stop the state's efforts to keep, quote, radical gender and sexual ideology out of kindergarten through third grade, as if being gay, lesbian, or transgender is some sort of radical ideology. Just after the settlement, he can't help himself.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's anything radical about putting up a sticker that tells children they're in a safe space. And I think there's something radical about a bill that forces people to scrape those stickers off windows and lockers, which is what was happening. But again, like in the end, we agree. I mean, great. None of those things should happen. And if if they want to portray those concerns as fanciful, you know, I don't think that's consistent with the reality of what was happening on the ground. But in all events, we agree now that they shouldn't happen. And I just welcome that and think that the clarity is incredibly useful.
Now, you know, I want to wrap up just to talk about the future. One of the things that came to mind when I first read about the settlement is, you know, well, how is this binding on subsequent administrations? Like, what's stopping the next governor from saying, you know what, I know that we said this was the considered judgment of the state, but, you know, I've changed my mind. Like, how is this going to bind the state moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, look, the state can, people after a litigation resolves can always go try something new, and there may be more litigation if they do. I mean, I think it would be hard to now redefine the very same words to mean something different. Having said this now repeatedly to a federal judge, having put it in a public agreement, having signed their name to it, having, you know, very senior people come out and express support for it and declare it a win for them. I mean, I think it would be pretty difficult to now say we think those words mean something different than what we previously said. And look, if they go amend what the words are and pass a new statute, then I'm sure we and any number of others will look at that and try to assess whether another lawsuit is the appropriate course. So hard to predict the future, but further Michigas, if I can borrow a term Robbie taught me, further Michigas may well lead to further litigation.
Or, you know, I would add too, like, we've secured relief for people now, which is fantastic. But
right.
If you want to see the definition of ambiguity and vagueness, how about having administrations interpreting the same words in antithetical ways?
Like, look, I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. And, you know, and I also think that the career people in the Solicitor General or the Attorney's Office are going to stay true to their word. But, you know, they take direction from the governor. And as we've seen in the presidential context, sometimes people come in and decide they just want to upset the apple cart. And, you know, that was, like I said, that was one of the things that stood out to me, was like, this is a great deal, but how long lasting is it? Is there any rumblings that you've heard that, you know, maybe the legislature will take action and amend the statute to be more in keeping with the settlement agreement?
Hadn't heard that. And, you know, I think at this point, with the settlement agreement having pretty forcefully defined these terms in the wake of both filings and a judicial order, you know, I'm not sure that further legislative change, you know, while, of course, more clarity is never something.
Sure. It's never
reject.
A bad thing.
Yeah, but I think we've established, you know, we've established quite a bit of clarity here. So it's not something that we see as critically needed here.
Yeah. Well, Brandon and John, thank you so much. I mean, this is just an outstanding victory, you know, to do what you've done here and to be able to protect the rights of these parents, students, teachers is just, you know, kudos to you both and kudos to Robbie and the rest of your team. This was just an incredible undertaking. I can't imagine how much time you spent on it, but and credit to the state's lawyers who were willing to come to the table and negotiate in good faith and come up with a resolution. I think that it seems like everyone's pretty happy with.
Yeah, agreed. And if I could add one more to your list, I mean, first of all, we did have a really fantastic team, both here at Kaplan Hecker. I mean, a number of really brilliant lawyers worked on it here. We had an excellent co-counsel at the National Center for Lesbian Rights, led by Shannon Minter, who's such a
force. Forgot to mention them. Yeah.
Yeah, as Robbie is. And, you know, we had local counsel in Florida who were fantastic. And of course, we had plaintiffs. I mean,
of course.
It's important to emphasize especially in these kinds of cases, which can become public and become scary.
I was just going to say, they're putting themselves out there.
Yeah. And we're talking sometimes about, you know, pretty young students, parents, you know, individual teachers facing all the incentives we've talked about who are ready to stand up and put their name on it anyway. Yeah. So we took a lot of strength from them. We took a lot of guidance from them, got a lot of information from them. And Equality Florida and Family Equality, our organizational plaintiffs too, who are just so on the ground, so knowledgeable about these issues. I mean, it was from clients to counsel, just an incredible team, and really couldn't have done it without everybody.
Yeah, I mean, this is just such a righteous case. Again, congratulations to you both. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
For having us.
All right, folks, that's a wrap. Thank you all for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast, share it with your friends and colleagues. I want to thank John and Brandon again for joining me. I also want to thank my friend Chris Clark of Pendulum Productions for editing and producing this podcast. You can find him and his work at vimeo.com/PendulumProductionsLLC. And remember, folks, case law is one word. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not an advertisement for legal services. The information provided on this podcast is not intended to be legal advice. You should not rely on what you hear on this podcast as legal advice. If you have a legal issue, please contact a lawyer. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are solely those of the individuals and do not represent the views or opinions of the firms or organizations with which they are affiliated or the views and opinions of this podcast's advertisers. This podcast is available for private, non-commercial use only. Any editing, reproduction, or redistribution of this podcast for commercial use or monetary gain without the expressed written consent of the podcast's creators is prohibited.